show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Bouncing ball, Moustakas, fair ball. Sets, throws, Royals win it. Kansas City, you've got a World Series.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me is the indefatigable Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this fantastic Kansas City off day evening?
I kind of don't want them to have an off day. They were playing so well.
It's actually fun.
It's like,
so it's still hard for me to get used to.
It
say
is.
What you will. It's been a year and a half now, but it's still tough to get used to not. I mean, I never dread watching the Royals because it was always fun to watch, but it was kind of just like, ah, oh, man, Twitter's going to explode. Something's going to happen. But those days are gone. And it's awesome.
Even when they would have a lead and were playing okay in like 2013, it was like, okay, well, how are they going to mess
this
up
this
time?
Yeah.
That's what they do. But no, they haven't done that much this year. Like, I was just looking earlier, the worst losing streak all year is 4 games.
Wow.
Yeah. Nuts. And it's like that was in May and June. So, I mean,
that harkens me back to, remember 2012, our time debacle?
Yeah.
They were 3-2, and we were like, okay, this team might be onto something. 12 straight losses. 12 straight.
10 at home, the opening home. And then, like, you look at it now, Royals just went 8-2 on the homestand. And if not for a couple of weird bullpen games, would have swept it. So, just like, okay, it's a whole new world.
Yeah, and, you know, when the Royals were the hottest of the hot last year when they won like 15 out of 21 or whatever it was in the second half of the season, you could have said, you know, Royals fans, and some did say like, oh, Royals are the best team in the league right now, even though they didn't have the best record or hadn't really proven that they were truly the best team, you know, and it was almost like an overcompensation for just like, you know, wanting to be in that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no overcompensation now. It's legit. Like, you can say with confidence, Royals are clearly the best team in the American League. And, you know, some other fan bases are going to pipe up and they'll talk about, you know, the Royals versus other teams. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But it's crazy when you can legitimately say the Royals are the best team in baseball.
I don't really know a time when I could say that. I was alive for 85, but shoot, I wouldn't even know what the best team in baseball meant when I was that age. I would have no idea.
And it was likely different than what it means to be that team in that position now.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's like, this is cool because I can drive to the games.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a big difference from being 5.
Indeed. So we got a couple of topics we're going to go a little bit more in depth about in the second part of the show. But first, we're going to go with some quick hits, some current developments with the Royals. And, you know, I mentioned this to Mike when we were discussing topics for the show and everything over email earlier. And it's really interesting that this is, I think I sent you this email today, Mike, where I was like, you know, the Royals are no stranger to meaningless September baseball, but it's such a role reversal to be meaningless September baseball because they're so good and their lead is so big that there's just no way they can be caught. I mean, obviously there's a way, but you know, this team, the type of epic collapse and the type of epic run that a team like the Twins or the Tigers would have to make to catch the Royals during their epic collapse, like, it's just a confluence of events that I mean, I'd have to look it up, but I would bet historically something like that is just, it's never probably happened, and there's probably a reason for that.
I think I saw a tweet yesterday, and I don't remember the source of this, so I don't remember where it came from, but it was like some Stats Inc. or ESPN Stats or something like that, where the only one team that had a 12-game lead with less than 50 games to go in their season that did not win their division or league or what have you was like the Dodgers in 51.
Wow.
So like one team. I mean, I don't know how many instances there are of 12 game leads with, you know, 50 games to go. Cause you got to look, you know, the pre-expansion era, it was all just one league.
Right.
So there's probably, if a team was that far ahead, well, probably a reason they didn't give it up because they were just that much better than the rest of the league. But, you know, I mean,
I would be curious to know how many teams have been in that scenario where they've had a 12 game lead with less than 50 to play. I mean, even as like the Royals are four games behind the Cardinals right now, four and a half, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And the Cardinals only have a 5-game lead in their own division. So, you know, the fact that you can have a team that's doing even better than the Royals record wise and even they aren't leading by 12 games. I mean, it's got to be a meeting of two events where you are really good and all the other teams in your division are just really bad.
Yeah, and that's what the Royals kind of ran into. I mean, Cleveland looked like, you know, a lot of people thought they were going to take a big step and they have been hurt and they've underperformed and different things. The White Sox made a lot of moves, but they didn't hit for the first 2 months, and now they aren't really pitching. And the Tigers have been hurt, and their pitching staff has been a wreck. I think they still got the most runs allowed in the majors, or at least the American League. And then, you know, you get injuries to Cabrera. Now they've sold their guys off, and so you have the Twins, who nobody has bought from day one. And the Royals. And so, yeah, the Royals, they sure benefit from a really favorable division draw. But they've also played a lot of good teams and they beat a lot of good teams. And you just look on the field and, you know, you look at their numbers and their stats, it's not really a fluke. They're playing well. They're hitting a lot better than they were last year. Like their runs per game is up by like a full third of a run. You know, you got Hosmer and Kane and Morales in the middle of the lineup. And I mean, that's been one of the more productive trios in the American League. So I can't really sit here and say that, yeah, they're winning because their division's so bad. They're so far ahead because the division is bad, but I don't see, you know, I mean, they're still ahead of every other American League team. And they played every other American League team except Baltimore at this point. So,
yeah,
and not too concerned about, you know, the reputation because they're doing it on the field.
Yeah, I mean they're definitely proving it out. And even some of the, and again, this will be kind of one of the in-depth topics we get into in the second part of the show. But even some of the teams that the Royals have losing records against in the AL, you know, it's never just like, oh man, what are we going to do? The Royals just can't compete with this team, you know. Every single one, you know, they've proven they've belonged on every level, you know, even cross leagues looking at, I mean, they handled the Pirates pretty well, as good as the Pirates are. You know, they stuck with the Cardinals and basically, you know, one run here or there and they have a winning record. Same team. That's basically the way it is with all the teams that the Royals have played, you know, just another run here or there. And, you know, and that sounds like, oh, okay, well, that's just, you know, your normal excuse for pretty much everything. It's like, well, no, not really, because, you know, how many teams have, you know, especially recently, like Toronto, you know, I mean, Toronto played Minnesota. I think it was in Minnesota right after that 4-game series with the Royals, and just where they were just crushing them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 13-2 type of wins, you know, so, you know, you can definitely be dominated and completely outclassed by opponents. And the Royals have not been outclassed by any stretch of the imagination by anyone. Sure. And so, again, we'll get back into that a little bit more later. But as for right now, just some quick things we wanted to go over as far as the current Royals. Pretty pretty ho-hum 8-2 homestand, as you mentioned, Mike. And it's great to say that that's just kind of like, oh, you know, Royals going about their business. And they're not getting – my biggest concern wasn't that the Royals would get complacent, but it was that they would want to hit that fast forward button and go to October, be like October already. And so you lose focus, not because you're, you know, disinterested or anything like that, but because just you're so looking forward to something that's so far off. And I honestly think this is a credit to Ned Yost that he has been able to keep their focus on the here and now. And you look at, you know, we're recording this Monday night. So you look at Sunday night's game against the Angels on Sunday Night Baseball as a prime example. You know, they had the lead, the Angels tied it up, and then, you know, they Angels took the lead and the Royals tied it up. They went into extra innings, and then, you know, they took care of business and won it in extra innings. And, you know, it's being able to keep that type of focus it's just a credit to Ned Yost. But that's kind of an aside, really.
This isn't a Ned show, but
no. Sorry, were you going to say something?
Well, yeah, you're right. They could have. I mean, that could have easily been a game last night that, you know, you get into it and it's like, okay, well, fine, we can chalk this up to, you know, a tough loss, but whatever. But they didn't. I mean, they kept going. They got, you know, even like Drew Butera and Alex Rios contributed, and so they got everything from you know, role players and bench guys and you know, black sheep and everything. Yep. And it, you know, they were just as excited on their 71st win as they were on day one and everything else. So I it's really fun to watch, and I think that's just kind of, it's this team. It's just, that's their identity, is just they're gonna be in it. They're gonna be ready to celebrate everything. And I think that keeps them primed on the field too. So if that's Yost, if that's, you know, the guy's familiarity with each other, if that's, you know, I don't know what it is. I don't know what the magic sauce is, but that's, you know.
But I want some.
It works, yeah. I mean, bottle it up and put it in storage.
I mean, you look at, let's say, the Kansas City Chiefs, right? In 2013, you know, they made the playoffs, and just a soul-crushing loss to the Indianapolis Colts in the playoffs. And, you know, obviously that wasn't the World Series, but at the same time, you know, the Chiefs have had a sordid playoff history as well. So the 2014 season, their mantra was kind of finish. You know, don't let those, you know, don't let a 38-10 lead slip away like they did in the playoffs, and finish. And that was what they kind of said, and that was what they were preaching. But excuse me, you saw them play on the field, and that wasn't what they were actually doing. But this year, the Royals have kind of adopted that, like, you know, we're not satisfied after last year. We're not satisfied with just being there. We're not satisfied with just getting back to the playoffs again. You know, we want to win it all. And that was kind of the mantra, if you will. But you see it on the field, you see it in their focus, their determination, their energy. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to see. And that's what makes the Royals, I think, a prohibitive favorite to kind of get that best team in the American League title, just because no other team plays like the Royals do.
Yeah. And they have a lot of ways to contribute and a lot of ways to do it. And when you have that defense, you're going to be in just about any game. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for the first part of the year, a lot of it was the starting rotation was a little rough. You know, there have been stretches where they didn't hit that well. But when that team's hitting, playing defense, and getting pitching behind them, they're going to be tough to beat. It's one of the things that you said when we were bringing things up was like, it's really easy to forget how good the Royals actually are, and that, you know, we see them every day. So we see the flaws and the problems. But, you know, that's kind of what we fixate on, because it's like you worry about it because that's your team. And you see all the good things. You see Toronto crushing things. We don't see that they're, you know, terrible in one run games. So, but you just see like the 13-2 score that they put up. And so you forget that the Royals are really darn good too, and that there are other fan bases that don't want to play the Royals because the Royals seem to just find those ways to win. And, you know, I think that they're out to continue to prove things too. So I think that's driving them as much as anything. They're kind of a cocky, swaggy kind of group of guys. And A lot of people wrote them off before the season even started, and I think they were ready to show that last year wasn't a fluke and that, you know, yeah, you can make a big jump like last year and continue it into the next year and not just maintain, but be better. And that's what they're doing so far. They're better than they were last year, and they were really good last year.
Yeah. And following with that theme, kind of the first thing that we wanted to talk about as far as current hits, if you will, would be a couple of hitters, Lorenzo Cain and Eric Hosmer, both of which, you know, Hosmer didn't have his best season last year, but he really turned it on in the playoffs and was a big part of the team's run. And Lorenzo Cain did have his best year last year. And there was a question, you know, is Lorenzo Cain, we've never seen it for an extended period until last year, you know, was last year just like, what was it, 2012, that Escobar hit over 300, you know, was it that type of year, the exception as opposed to the rule, or is he setting a new baseline for his talent level since he had a full year of being healthy and being on the field and everything else? And right now it looks like the latter is true for Lorenzo Cain, because he's having an even better season than he did last year. It seems like every time the Royals need somebody to come through, Lorenzo Cain comes up big. And, you know, as far as Hosmer is concerned, I think we're starting to see, starting to confirm some suspicions that he's ultimately going to be a streaky hitter. And that's kind of who he is. And I saw David Leske made a post or a tweet about this a little while ago. And it was a good point where it was, as good as Hosmer is, what's stopping him from being a truly elite player is, you know, and to a certain extent, every hitter is streaky. Mm-hmm. But when his lows are ungodly low, you know, Miguel Cabrera
sustained.
Yes. You know, Miguel Cabrera is going to have a low and he's going to hit 270, you know, and then he's going to come back and he's going to light it up at 400
right.
for a stretch, you know, and that's kind of how he ends up at the 330, 350 batting average range. Whereas Eric Hosmer, you know, he typically would be in that like 320, 330 range for his hot stretches, but dipping into like the 190s for his extremely cold stretches. And so what we've seen this year that's been impressive is his hot stretches. When he is hot at the plate, he's an elite hitter in baseball. He is everything we thought he would be. He's mashing at a, you know, 400 clip. He's taking pitches. He's walking, getting on base that are like 450 clip. He's OPSing over 1,000. That's at his peak. And no one can sustain that for a year. That's not what you expect. But then he dips into those valleys and they're still as low as they always were, where you're below 200 for 2-3 weeks a month at a time. That's what's killing Eric Hosmer right now from just an overall perspective. But so far this year, the good times have outweighed the bad. And I mean, right now he's in one of those hot streaks where he's seeing the ball really well. He's crushing it. He's hitting home runs. I mean, he's looking really good. And when you've got Lorenzo Cain hitting 3 and Hosmer hitting 4, I mean, you're setting
a lot of runs.
Pretty good.
And the thing with Hosmer is his run here, you know, I mean, his last 36 games, really 35, because one of those was as a defensive replacement. He's hitting 404, 456, and slugging 640. He's got, you know, 6 homers. He's walked a bunch of times. But that all started, like, you can go back to where the climb started the same day that Alex Gordon got hurt. And it's just like, okay, exactly when you need someone to step up, he steps up and becomes this monster. His last 10 games, I mean, ESPN said this a lot, and this was all over Twitter yesterday, he drove in a run in 10 straight games, and he's still on that streak. You know, he's got, you know, since July 8th, he's got 3 games where he didn't get a hit. So, and a lot of those games, he's gotten 2 or more hits, or he's gotten a hit and a walk. You know, and then, you know, just earlier on the homestand, he had 3 homers in 4 games. He had an extra base hit in like 9 straight games. And it's just like every time he's up, you expect him to do something. He's just so locked in right now. Last night was a great example of it. First inning, he hits a hard grounder through the infield, drives in a run. But later in the game, he doesn't chase pitches that he would have chased even this past May. He's patient at the plate, ends up drawing a walk, and ends up scoring the tying run. So it's just he's just zoned in every way. It's kind of fun to see. I hope he can continue at least staying kind of hot, or if he does dip, you know, he bounces right back. Lorenzo Cain has been really hot all year, but he even had like I think like an 0 for 12 stretch, but he came right back. You know, it was just that was all it was. It was this little blip, and immediately, boom, he turned it right back on. So, you know, just one bad week, and then he goes on like a 6-game hitting streak.
Yeah, Cain has been the most impressive to me for that very reason that you just mentioned. That, you know, he's had a few tad blips. I think at one point he was in like the 295 range in terms of batting average. But I mean, like you said, he snapped out of that real quick. His lows are not nearly as prolonged as Hosmer's, mm-hmm. Which is a very good thing. And he's, you know, hitting a crazy 314. And again, he's got the 367 on base percentage. And, you know, I've kind of mentioned it before, you know, this is not, there's no statistical basis for this, but just my kind of personal, I like to see like a 50 point, you know, difference between, you know, ISO on base percentage, if you will. I don't even know if that's
a thing. Yeah, it's about but, what it comes down to, yeah.
I mean, because I think, because that demonstrates, you know, some selectiveness, some ability to kind of navigate the plate, if you will. Whereas, you know, if you're much less than that, then you're talking the Salvador Perez, Omar Infante territory, yeah, where you're looking at literally single digit walks,
right?
You know, for an extended period of time. But, and 500 slugging for Lorenzo Cain. I mean, he's just like, he's having such a great season, and his defense is so amazing. And, you know, Hosmer probably, relatively speaking, plays just as good a defense at first base as Lorenzo Cain does at center field, but center field is just infinitely more valuable,
right,
than first base. So it's not a comparison. Yeah, it's not a comparison. You know, it's first base might be, defensively speaking, the least value. I don't know, least valuable defense.
It's lowest on the traditional defensive spectrum. Because
yeah,
if David Ortiz can play it regularly, that's kind of where you're at.
That should say enough right there.
Right.
But
you look at, if you could pick out highlights of Hosmer at first and say, yep, that definitely saved a run like that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not a theoretical, that literally saved a run this and that.
The fact that you can save a run at first base being Eric Hosmer is a pretty crazy and fantastic thing.
He's done it a lot. And yes, they're both so locked in. They're fourth and sixth in batting average in the American League right now, which is just awesome. I'm just looking at Cain's numbers right now, and his walks are higher in fewer plate appearances than last year. His strikeouts are way down. All of his slugging numbers are way up. So it's
his ISO slugging percentage is up. I mean, I'm looking at his stats too, Adam pulled up, but it's crazy too that according to Fangraphs, his WAR, he's already eclipsed his WAR from last year.
Yeah.
Already. There's 45 games less to play, and he's played 30 less games than he played all of last year. So, I mean, man, he's having a special season. And
he's going to get MVP votes.
Yeah, he won't win, but he's going to get MVP votes, and he should.
Yeah.
He absolutely should. You know, I think people, because you're going to get the majority of people that are voting for your MVPs are going to have the counting stats. Like, okay, I'm going to look at the really good teams and the players that I know. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people are going to come into this season, especially with that kind of a confirmation bias, if they will. Like, okay, I think Mike Trout's the MVP because I hear about him, talk about him. He won last year. Oh, I'm going to look at his, I'm going to look at his stats. And okay, and 30, he's 40 home runs, 330 batting average, all this stuff. So it confirms the preconceived bias. He's going to win. So, you know, and that's fine. But, you know, the people that try and be a little bit more reasoned about their approach, and not that necessarily Mike Trout would be undeserving, because he definitely deserves
it.
But, you know, looking at Lorenzo Cain, I mean, I always try and look at those arguments as, you know, who is providing the most value, who's giving the most wins theoretically, you know, not talking WAR necessarily, but just kind of from an abstract perspective, who's giving the most wins. Like, I like to compare it to football. You know, I like to see Peyton Manning, you know, maybe not necessarily now, but, you know, as of a few years ago and the majority of his career, just him stepping on the field every game guarantees you 4 wins, basically, you know, and because he was so skilled. Whereas, you know, a lot of quarterbacks, Alex Smith, you might be guaranteed one just because of how good he is. You know, so that's the type of definition that you're going to give him if he's going to win you four games on his own. You know, and so again, that's an abstract theory. It's not a statistical thing. But when you talk about, you know, the Lorenzo Cain as MVP type candidate versus Mike Trout, I mean, Mike Trout was a rookie in 2012. He was in 2011, but, you know, and then 2013, 2014, and then this year, mm-hmm. right? And they've only made the playoffs once. Right. And it was last year. They ran the other best team in the league, but they got swept by the Royals.
And Trout got one hit.
And since Lorenzo Cain has had, and there's a lot of other factors, you know, but since Lorenzo Cain in 2013 wasn't as a rookie year, but effectively, you know, because he 2012 was wiped out by a lot of injuries and he didn't really spend much time with the Brewers in the majors. So, you know, he'd only played a little over 100 games. So I guess, you know, his first full year, more or less, in 2013. And that was the first year the Royals had a winning record in however long, you know, 10 years. And then every year he's played more and they've gotten better. So, I mean, there's extraneous factors there, you know, but because that was coincided with the arrival of James Shields and Eric Hosmer and all that playing better and all that kind of stuff. So it's not just Lorenzo Cain, but that's just an interesting side note. But that's it from the hitters. And then when talking about, you know, moving forward, looking towards the playoffs, a lot of conversation has been about what's the rotation in the playoffs going to be. Playoffs only need a four-man rotation. So Guthrie is out. I think everybody kind of knows that.
Right.
So the question is, if Guthrie's out, you know, Cueto obviously in a number one slot. He's starting first game of every series, and he's pitching the most. Then Volquez absolutely earned that solid number two slot. Those are not going to change, providing an injury or unless there's an injury or some sort of drastic collapse.
Right.
So the question is, who has the remaining two spots? And the conventional wisdom says Danny Duffy, Yordan Ventura, start him up, let's go. But they've been so wildly inconsistent this year. You know, it's kind of like, well, maybe Chris Medlin should be there. Maybe Chris Young. What are we going to do? I don't know. But recently, Danny Duffy and Yordan Ventura have been pitching quite a bit better, especially Yordan Ventura. His last two starts, he's only given up a total of two runs. And was it last night?
Yeah, it was last night.
Yeah. Last night, he pitched seven innings, gave up two runs, seven strikeouts, one walk. He did give up the one home run, but, you know, that's a line from Johnny Cueto. That's pretty much identical to a line Cueto had two starts ago, where he had seven innings pitched, gave up a couple runs, and had, I think Cueto had eight strikeouts or something, maybe in that game. Maybe that was a complete game. But either way, like, if you had this line from Johnny Cueto, you'd be pleased, and you'd say that was what an ace does. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a step forward. And then, you know, Danny Duffy as well has really put the. Do you still have his stats pulled up? Because I'm looking at Ventura here, so I didn't.
Yeah, Duffy. He's had such a weird year. Like, his first few starts, he looked pretty good, and he had that really good start in Detroit, and then right after that in May, he just lost all of his command. He was walking a lot of guys. He was leaving fastballs in there. Didn't have anything but his fastball, and so teams were just sitting on it. And, you know, he said that he had some shoulder tightness. You know, who knows? And then he went and did his rehab work and came back. And since he's come back, he's been a completely different pitcher and a more successful one at that. It's kind of weird. He's sitting on a 4.03 ERA, but really, since he came back from the disabled list, he's got a 2.85 ERA. And he's doing it by not really striking guys out. He's only struck out, I think, like 30 guys in 60 innings. But he's getting the ball in play, and he's going deeper into games. And with the exception of a couple of games, he's pretty much throwing very well. I mean, he's got six innings or more in eight out of his 10 starts. He's given up one run or fewer, or one earned run or fewer in seven of those 10 starts. So he's been very sharp in those games. He just doesn't get strikeouts, which is strange to see since he jumped up into the big leagues being like a 7 or 8, you know, strikeout per nine kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he can throw 95 to 97 from the left side. He's got a good changeup and came up with a good curve. He's added a slider. And you would think that kind of a repertoire, if he can be average with a couple of those secondary pitches and be good with the fastball, you'd think that that's going to be a strikeout guy. But he really hasn't done that. And I don't know if that's that his stuff isn't good enough to get swings and misses, or if that's definitely an approach thing that he's trying to not nibble like he's been prone to do, you know, earlier in his career, you know, 2012, 2013, where he was trying to get the strikeout versus, you know, being willing to get the ball in play. So I'd be interested to ask him that if I ever got the chance, because it seems like that might be the case, but I also don't know if it's just that he doesn't have quite the same stuff for the swing and miss as he used to. But all that is just to say that he's thrown very well in his start since coming back. He definitely looks like the guy at that number three that, yeah, I mean, I think 3 or 4 out of 5 starts, he might be good in that fourth or fifth. He might be a little rough, but I think he's going to be good more often than not. And I think the Royals would feel comfortable putting him third in a series as long as he's healthy and as long as he's, you know, still got the command that he's shown in the last couple months.
Yeah, and, you know, he's such a fascinating guy to watch just from – and I don't mean, like, physically watching when he's on the mound, just in terms of what you see with your eyes – and what you see on paper don't always match up with Duffy, because like what you're talking about, you know, he came up, he's supposed to be that big strikeout pitcher. In his first couple of years, you know, he had some struggles, but he showed that, you know, his rookie season, he had a 5+ ERA, but he struck out a lot of batters. And his second season, you know, he was kind of cruising towards that way before he had his Tommy John surgery. And then last year, he cooled off quite a bit in terms of strikeouts, but still had, you know, an acceptable, I think it was 6.8, which is his K per, yeah, 6.8 right. Was a strike per nine, you know, and now it's down to 5.3. And another thing that I noticed that was kind of weird when you look at Duffy, like, okay, last year, he had a 2.53 ERA, which is fantastic. And his FIP last year, which, you know, we've kind of gone over it before, but for those that are unfamiliar, don't remember, you know, the FIP is fielding independent pitching, which more or less kind of tries to take away, I don't know all the calculus behind it, but it ultimately takes away what the defense does to try and just get at the things that a pitcher can control: strikeouts, walks, home runs, things like that aren't impacted by how good or bad his defense is behind him. So you, as good as the Royals defense is, you're expecting it with every pitcher for the Royals to be higher. So that's not, you know, unusual, mm-hmm. But his FIP last year was 3.83, which is 1.3 runs higher than his ERA. So that, you know, even as good as the Royals defense is, that's a pretty big gap. And you start to wonder, you know, kind of what that is. And then his XFIP, which XFIP stands for expected fielding independent pitching, which basically does all the same things and then normalizes the home run rate for the league average home run rate. So again, most Royals pitchers who pitch in Kauffman for an entire season, you know, you're going to expect a little bit of increase in it, because it's Royals, you know, Kauffman is a pitcher's park, so you're going to give up less home runs. So you can expect a little bit of a gap there. And his last year was 4.42. So we're talking almost 2 runs difference between his ERA and his expected fielding independent pitching. So, I mean, that's a pretty big gap, even considering the Royals defense and Kauffman Stadium. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'm underestimating both those things, and that's just kind of what you would expect. I guess I haven't really looked at the other pitchers to see how they stack up. And I'm going to do that. We're going to pull
okay.
that up.
Okay. Right. I think I've seen Hunter Samuels has brought some of these up, where guys like Chris Young and even Jeremy Guthrie have been guys who have traditionally outpitched their FIP and XFIP. And I don't know if that's just something that is part of the scouting and targeting by Dayton Moore, where he's like, okay, we know that we have this defense. We know that, okay, this is what it says, but we also understand that our guys are going to be good enough to fight against that. And right. I don't know if it's like a conscious thing or if it's like a primary thing or if it's just one of those things that like, okay, we like this guy. And there's also this factor that works within, you know, our team mindset
right.
and our general strategy. I mean, it could be column A, column B, and everything else.
Right.
So
interesting comparison point here. James Shields last year, he had a 3.21 ERA, which is still very good.
Uh-huh.
His FIP was 3.59, and his XFIP was 3.56. So
it's really small,
quite a bit close. I know. Weird that his XFIP was lower than his FIP was.
Yeah. Mm. What is it this year in San Diego?
This year, it's 4.18 was his FIP and 3.43 is his XFIP. His XFIP is actually lower than his ERA, which is 3.89.
Huh.
So that's interesting.
Well, that's a bad defense in San Diego, too.
That's a very bad. Yeah, it's true. That's a very bad defense.
So that, I mean, I maybe that's the value of defense. Maybe that's the hidden thing that it makes guys so much better. I don't know. That's something for more study, maybe. But
yeah, and it's interesting that his kind of his numbers are a little bit tighter in there. But the one thing that's kind of a bigger difference is his. You look at James Shields' BABIP. Last year was 295, and last year Duffy was sitting at 239, which is an incredibly low BABIP. And, you know, even for pitchers who can historically kind of outperform the norm, like a Bruce Chinn, who was just a fascinating, his ability to consistently, you know, considering league-wide average, usually considered about 300 BABIP for hitters and pitchers, you know, Bruce Chinn was constantly in that 270, 280 range and just kind of who he was, which, you know, so even if you were to be that kind of pitcher as Danny Duffy, 239 is still one of those unsustainable kind of things. And that definitely goes back to Royals defense last year. But his BABIP this year is 287. So it's almost as if it's really just that's what's driving all this uptick in numbers here. And it's kind of fascinating to really look at it that way, especially because when I talk about, you know, seeing meshing what you see with your eyes with what we see on paper, and when you see Duffy pitch, you know, first of all, you think he should be striking people out more because his stuff is still good even when you see it in person. He nibbles too much, and he gets kind of – sometimes he gets too – focused on the strikeout, I think, still not as much as he used to, but I think that's when he gets in trouble, when he really it used to be entire at bats, I think, that he was just like, I've got to strike out. And now I think it's just he gets in situations where it's like, okay, this needs to be a strikeout pitch, and then he can kind of dial himself back if he doesn't get it. That's just, again, purely anecdotal on my part. It's just kind of what I've noticed, my amateur scouting eye, if you will.
Right.
But also, you know, I don't see, I mean, do you agree with this? Just from what I've seen when Duffy pitches, I don't see a ton of like really solid hard hit contact. I mean, do you, I don't know exactly where to look up the hard hit percentage. I know it's out there, but I mean, do you see him getting hit around pretty hard? Because I really don't, but maybe I just haven't been watching at the right time.
Not really. I mean, nothing stands out where he's just leaving a lot of stuff out there. I mean, there were, you know, when it happens, when he's bad, it's really bad. It's like the series in Texas where they learned early on that he was not comfortable with any of his secondary stuff. And so any fastball that was anywhere on the plate, they were just sitting on it. And in that kind of situation, that's kind of all he has, is he has the fastball. And if he's got to rely on that, then, you know, that's going to be a problem. But you see a game like that, and then you compare it to just any other game, and I don't see him get hit around too much. I see a lot of times where, you know, they might be making more contact on him. And if you look at, like, his strikeout rate, and his BABIP this year, where his strikeout rate is down and his BABIP is up, that's a lot of balls that get put in play. And I think anytime you've got the ball going into play, it's got an opportunity to get through. Even with the best defense in baseball behind you, you still have that opportunity for the ball to find a hole. You know, you can make the perfect pitch on a guy, shatter his bat, and it'll still bloop over the third baseman. You know, that will happen. That's just one of those things. But if you'd make that same pitch 9 times out of 10, it's probably a pop-up out. But that one time it falls in, it counts as a hit. So I'm not sure if that's what's going on, but it seems like he's allowing a lot of contact. But he's not. I mean, if he was allowing a lot of contact and it was all hard, I don't think you'd be seeing the results, even with that wide disparity between his ERA and the FIP and XFIP. I think if you get hit hard at a high enough rate, you're going to give up a ton of runs just because hard hit balls usually go for hits. So nothing that I've seen really tells me that, and nothing that I recall in most of his starts this year have really shown me that he's getting hit hard. It can just be a matter of leaving stuff up and having one bad inning and then, you know, seeing what happens from there. And, but I think you're right on, like, he looks like a guy who should be getting more strikeouts and who should be more dominating during the games. He's 6'3", so he's a tall guy. Mm-hmm. He throws hard. You know, guys who throw hard generally get strikeouts. And, it's kind of rare to see a guy throw 95 and not be striking out 6 or 7 guys per 9 innings. But he doesn't really do it. And
yeah, and
at least okay. Now.
Right. And interestingly, so I was able to find on Baseball Reference, awesome site, by the way, but I was able to find some, not necessarily hard hit balls, but we've got hit trajectory, ground ball, fly ball, or line drive, bunts. Typically line drives are going to be harder hit than all the rest, even though I think, does hard hit balls, do they count grounders in those, or are they only line drives?
No, they count grounders.
They do. Okay. So you're going to get kind of a mix of those there. but I'm trying to pull up your Yordan Ventura's stats so we can get some comparison here. But because interestingly,
I remember with Ventura early in the year, there were a lot of hard hit, like hard contact and hard pull contact, which is even stranger for a guy who throws 101.
Yeah. And so Danny Duffy has given up 60 hits that are line drives, right? And only 37 hits that are either ground balls or fly balls. Okay. So that's not necessarily, to have a huge line drives are going to be hits more often than any other type of hit. The batting average on line drives from Danny Duffy is .659 and a 1,000 slugging, 1,645 OPS on line drives.
But I think line drives generally are like 65 to 75% of the time they're going to be a hit.
Yordan Ventura,
league-wide,
his .695 is his line drive batting average. So, Yordan Ventura has given up quite a bit more line drives as well. So we're going to pull up Johnny Cueto because we're just going to look this up very quick. we initially intended for this to be a shorter segment, but sometimes we got to get derailed. Big surprise.
Shocker.
Big surprise on this show. So this will be the last thing we kind of look up, but I am incredibly curious. So we're going to have to check this out here.
Cueto is a guy who has the last like 3 years combined, he's got the lowest batting average against.
Right.
So I think that you're going to see that he doesn't give up a lot of line drives, and even when he does, they don't go for hits as often.
Yeah.
So would be my guess.
Cueto has pitched in 5 more games than Duffy, and he has only given up 4 more line drive hits. And his batting average on line drives is .552.
Yeah.
So, you're looking at over 100 points lower.
Which feels significant.
Again, yes, but again, it's Johnny Cueto versus Danny Duffy, so you would expect there to be a difference there. Ultimately, I think it's reasonable to conclude what we were kind of saying, where, there's just not a ton of really hard, solid contact. It's just, it seems to be kind of BABIP driven, but I don't know. That's just my you know, we did a little, Mike and I kind of tossed this around and did a little research before the show. And then now we're kind of, as we're looking at it. So, you know, nothing super scientific or conclusive, but interesting nonetheless. And on that note, we're going to take a short break and then we're going to come back. We have a couple extra topics, not extra, but a couple other topics that we're going to talk about in terms of Royals and, you know, possibly documenting some of their fate in the playoffs possibly this year. So stick with us and we'll be back on the other side.
Kansas City Irish Fest is going to be September 4th, 5th, and 6th this year. And as always, Kelly's Westport Inn is the official after party for any KC Irish Fest attendee. When the ceremonies finish up at Crown Center at 11 p.m. each night, Kelly's Westport Inn becomes the destination to grab a pint and celebrate your Irish heritage. On Saturday and Sunday nights, there will be shuttle buses that will take you from Irish Fest at Crown Center all the way to Westport. That's all happening Labor Day weekend, September 4th, 5th, and 6th. Irish Fest until 11, and then Kelly's Westport Inn.
And welcome back in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport. And thank you for sticking with us through that break. And we talked in the first segment, a couple of things leading up to, you know, Lorenzo Cain, Eric Hosmer staying hot, Danny Duffy, Yordan Ventura hopefully keeping their recent momentum going towards the playoffs. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk now, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, it's really interesting, the Royals having a boring September, not because they're so bad, but because they're so good. Let's hope it stays boring anyway. When we actually get there, you know, we're not in September yet, but when we get there, let's hope it's still boring. Boring from a sports talk perspective, going out to the games, watching it on TV, it's funner now, right? But just from a, what are we going to talk about? Just like when the Royals are really, really bad and there's not much more you can say.
You're just kind of ready for the next part.
Yeah. So anyway, so we've kind of looked in our email chain back and forth over the last, you know, week or so, and something that's kind of sparked my interest. We talk about comparisons, and this is another thing that, you know, they mean very little because, you know, the Royals are different than typically just about any other team you could imagine in recent history. And, you know, circumstances are different. So other teams are different, but it's always fun to kind of look at these things. So, you know, let's take a look. And it was sparked by one of the things that I saw David Leske tweet on Twitter again, where he mentioned, what was it? Something like 16 teams had lost Game 7 of the World Series, and I can't remember how many made the playoffs the next year or something like that, or even made the World Series, or so. I can't remember what the statistic was. And that's what it was. It was their average record the next year, which was 89 wins or something like that. And this is a little bit ago, but the Royals are on pace to go well beyond that. So I was like, okay, just trying to think in my head what teams I could think of in recent history that lost Game 7. And the first one I could think of was the 2011 Rangers, who lost Game 7 to the St. Louis Cardinals. And looking at the Rangers, I noticed some kind of very interesting similarities because, you know, they made the playoffs the next year. That was that the first year of the second wild card? I think it was, because they lost in 2012 after the 7. Because I think, let me check.
2012 was the first year, was it? Yeah.
See, yeah, lost the AL wild card 1-0.
Yeah.
So they lost that. I think that was the Rays they lost it to. But so in 2011, okay, because the Rangers, when I started looking at it, there were a lot of striking similarities to the Royals and how the Rangers kind of rose up, just as the Royals did. So you had a lot of those teams in the mid to late 90s for the Rangers that, you know, they made the playoffs and they were pretty good and, you know, went in 90 games a few times and whatnot. And then they kind of toiled in mediocrity and had, you know, they pop up and have a decent season here and there. And, you know, they won no more between 71 and 73 games from 2000 to 2003. And then 2004, they had an 89 win season, but they didn't make the playoffs. And they jump back down in the 70s, kind of low 80s, hanging around there. And then, but that kind of coincided with the time. And if you're a really long listener of the show, you'll remember when we had Alan Yeager on the show, and he, who runs a pitching camp out in California, and he's a big long toss guy. And he kind of helped when the Rangers overhauled the organization in the mid-2000s, and Nolan Ryan came aboard and John Daniels and all that, and then Alan Yeager kind of helped them install kind of a new pitching philosophy, a new pitching program to help their young pitchers, and they focused on pitching and having kind of a different philosophy on pitching than most people in the league at the time. You know, even so much as 10 years ago, a lot of things with long toss and different pitching programs and things would be, you know, way more ahead of their time than they are now. Whereas I think now it's getting to the point where most teams in the league are pretty well okay to just say, hey, do whatever you need to do to be successful. And so they kind of had that renewed focus on the farm system and developing from within, instead of, you know, in the past they made a lot of kind of acquisitions, like Jose Canseco type of acquisitions and stuff. But so then they slowly kind of started getting better, and you had 2007, they won 75 games. 2008, they won 79. 2009, they won 87 games, 87 and 75, which one game better than the Royals in 2013, when the Royals were 86 and 76. And then in 2010, the Rangers went 90 and 72, made the playoffs for the first time in 12 years. And the Royals last year went 89 and 73, again, one game off, and made the playoffs for the first time in, as we know, 29 years. And Rangers made the World Series, kind of came out of nowhere. Came out of nowhere for the general public. You know, people that are paying attention probably saw that the Rangers were getting better, just like people saw the Royals were getting better last year and the year before. And then made the World Series, lost to the Giants. So, I mean, we're starting to see some parallels here, right? And then they come back, and they're even more dominant. They finish 96 and 66, and the Royals right now are on pace for, I believe, 99 wins. Does that sound right? 98, 99?
Something like that,
somewhere
yeah.
in there.
I mean, if they go 500 the rest of the way, they got 94.
Yeah, so it's very, very possible they could be in that 96-win range.
Yeah.
And the Rangers went back to the World Series, and of course they lost Game 7, but then they made the playoffs again the next year. So, but one of the things that I really liked to look at that I thought was interesting is people talk about, you know, the Royals versus other teams in other playoff caliber teams in the American League and who they would play in the playoffs and their record against and so forth. And, how, you know, they're not exactly stellar, and we'll get a little bit more into that in a second. But, you know, you look at the Rangers from 2011, and, you know, they're in a very similar scenario because they basically just feasted on teams that they were better than and that they were in a good division. Or a good division in the sense that
– favorable division, yes, for them.
Just like the Royals are this year. Right. But, I mean, you look at, you know, some of the better teams in 2011. You know, the Rangers were 3-6 against the Detroit Tigers. They were they were 2-7 against the Yankees. They were 5-4 against the Rays. They were 4-6 against Toronto. I can't remember who made the playoffs last year. So they beat the Rays in the division series, and they were 5-4 against them in the regular season. And they beat the Tigers in the ALCS, and the Tigers were, they were good. They were 3-6 against the Tigers for most of the season, or for the regular season. So, you know, and I listened to Seren Petro's show a little while ago, and he kind of talked about both the American League and the National League over the last, however many, I can't remember how far back he went, 7 years or so. And the, average winning percentage for teams against the other playoff teams. And what was interesting was of the teams that lost the CS, both in the American and National League, it was like a 590 winning percentage against other playoff teams. But then the teams that went to the World Series were in that like 460 to 490 range. So kind of an interesting little paradigm there, and something to keep in mind to where, you know, even if the Royals don't have a winning record against a lot of the playoff teams. You know, there's, it's kind of what we talked about before, you know, when discussing after that Toronto series. July baseball, June, August baseball is different than October baseball.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't get too caught up in the, you know, oh, Royals are 2-4 against the Astros, or, you know, whatever the case may be, because it's not always as predictive as one would think.
Yeah, there, it's certainly different when you get to October. Like last year, the Royals, like I looked this up before, like Herrera, Davis, and Holland last year during the regular season threw about 14% of the Royals innings. When you got into the playoffs, they threw like 29% of the innings because you've got off days and travel days, and you can go, you know, five outs with a guy because, you know, you have an extra day of rest. And, you know, there's also the element of do or die. I mean, if you're in June, you might not go with your best option. You saw just even this past homestand where the Royals would go with guys like Morales and Madsen and Hochever out of the bullpen instead of Herrera, Davis, or Holland because they wanted to rest Davis because of a back thing, or they wanted to, you know, give Holland an extra day off or what have you, because they had a big lead and they also had other games that they had to kind of keep in mind. And so when you get to the playoffs, you don't have that concern. You can just go for it. Plus the lack of needing a fifth starter means that's another bullpen arm potentially. So it's a whole different animal playing in October versus playing, you know, in the middle of May, where you've got to look long term. So there are some games that maybe you play them differently. Maybe you approach them differently. But I mean, at the same time, it's like, hey, you've got to, the Royals beat teams that they were supposed to beat. What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
They're supposed to win those games. Why are you criticizing them for winning the games they're supposed to win?
Yeah. I mean, there's no shame in that. And there's just like, you know, and granted, you can't really have this excuse in the playoffs necessarily, but you know, you talk about how much different would it be if, you know, the game where the Royals played the Blue Jays in Toronto and Johnny Cueto pitches his first game and he leaves the game with a 6-3 lead.
Yeah.
Right. And they end up losing 7-6. Okay. So say the Royals keep that lead, you know, and they win that. And then instead of being 3-4 against the Blue Jays, now they're 4-3 against the Blue Jays and they've got a winning record. And then maybe when they went down to Houston early in the season, and it was, you know, that was right when I think Vargas went on the first stint on the DL. I think Greg Holland might have been on, Danny Duffy might have been on the DL as well. I mean, that was, they had just kind of had a rash of injuries right there that people couldn't, you know, felt like they were quite a bit hobbled again in that Houston series. Yeah. And so maybe if they're at full strength, even if they only win one of those games, then they're 500 against the Astros.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and you look at, you know, the Cardinals, they lost that last game against the Cardinals by one run in extra innings. Wasn't that it? Was it one run in extra? Am I thinking of the right game?
I don't know. Last, it's kind of
that makeup game.
Cardinals games.
Yeah. Let's see. We can check this out really quick, but,
I mean, and they played the Cardinals pretty tough in every game.
Yeah. There's never been years past where the Cardinals would just blow out the Royals.
Right. It's 8-2 in the third or something like that. And there was another game in Toronto where they came back and had it 3-2. And then, you know, final score was 5-2. But, I mean, it was right there. They had another opportunity. And it's just like, you know, against the Angels. The Angels are 1-6 against the Royals. But that one was just kind of a fluke comeback against the bullpen. That's another one. So it's just, you know, the Royals are right there. I mean, if we want to take a look at where they are against other contending AL teams, you know, I'm just, and in this case, I'm meaning contending teams by, you know, teams that are within three games of a wild card spot, which basically extends down to Tampa Bay, who are 2.5 out of the last wild card spot. The Royals are 28-22 against those teams. So, I mean, that's a 560 winning percentage. That's pretty solid. You know, that's not anything to be too worried about. the Blue Jays, for example, they're six games above 500 against AL contending teams. But a lot of these guys, they're close to 500 or below 500. The Yankees are 34 and 30. Houston's 26 and 23 against contending teams. You know, I mean, how much is it that Houston gets to play Seattle so many times and Oakland so many times? So, I mean, it's the same way in every division. There's always a team that's going to get beat. Boston's not good in the East. You know, Tampa, even though they're contending, they're under 500. So, I mean, they had to lose games to get to that point. So, you see a fairly even distribution among all of the contending teams, the favorites to get playoff spots, the division leaders, and the Royals. It's you know, everybody has to play about the same number of teams against about the same number of games against teams that are in contention, and about the same number of games against teams that are not in contention. So I think some people might wring their hands about the Royals getting to play the Twins and Indians and White Sox and Tigers, but I mean, the White Sox, Indians, and Tigers were all picked to win the division before the year too. So how bad can that division really be if there was enough talent for them to get picked in that spot by so many people? Yeah. It's like saying two different things. So I'm not too worried about that as far as, you know, what pundits might say.
Yeah. And, you know, point is that just a, you know, one run here or there and the perspective would completely change just because you're looking at win-loss records and not how games are played and how things are going to change in October, you know. So because, you know, you can make the same argument in reverse, right? And, you know, the Royals are 7-5 against the Indians and 7-6 against the Tigers. So a few runs here or there, and if they're 5-7 against the Indians and 6-7 against the Tigers, then are people feeling really bad? Like, man, we don't even have a winning record against the Tigers and the Indians, and they're not even good. Right. You know, it's like, it's just, you know, and not that it's irrelevant, but it's just something to not get as caught up in as some people are getting. and kind of with that, talking about, who, you know, Royals record against AL contending teams. I got a question for you, Mike.
Okay.
If Royals make the playoffs, you know, whatever it is, 98%, whatever the probability.
I think it's really 99. It's
just, is it really? I lowballed it at 98%.
Okay. Yeah, it's that's it's nuts. It's I don't even know how to best explain how just certain it is. It's so strange.
That's really crazy.
Like the combination of factors that would lead to them not making it are just I can't even. I don't even know. Yeah,
it's like Haley's Comet type of thing.
Right.
So let me ask you though, who would you, we've talked about, you know, how they've played against Toronto, Houston, New York, LA, Tampa Bay, whatever. Assuming any one of those teams that you considered AL contenders in your analysis, who are you, Michael Engel, most afraid of playing? Whether it's ALDS, ALCS, whatever.
Well, I'd rather not face any of them. I'd rather just
go straight to the World Series, right?
But I mean, you look at all of them. The Royals in New York, in Houston, and in Toronto didn't do that well on any front. They got bombed out of the stadium against the Yankees. The Astros were really tough at home. The Astros are really good at home anyway. And Toronto was, they played probably as good a baseball as anybody in the second half of the season, or at least since the trading deadline in the last, you know, 3 weeks or so. So, I mean, just my memory, and maybe this is just recency, but facing Toronto in Toronto when those guys were on was just like terrifying. It felt like no lead was safe. It felt like you could be up five and they could get within four hitters, be a run behind, be right back in it. And that is terrifying. you know, the lineup is so stacked, and now they have Troy Tulowitzki, and they got David Price, and they shored up their bullpen. Toronto, even with a 12-24 record in one run games, you know, they got better relievers. And so they've got a pretty nice combo at the back of the bullpen, and Aaron Sanchez and Antonio Osuna. I think that's his first name, Robert Osuna. Antonio Osuna, I think, was like an old Met from like 96. So plus, you know, when you're looking at these guys, you have to think, okay, well, they're going to be playing in that stadium. So, you know, you go to Toronto and they're so good at home. They're 40-23 at home. You know, whether that's just home cooking or if that's whatever conspiracy theory, we're not sure. You know, you get to that, you feel almost like they could win a game at Kauffman, and then it's really tough to beat them in Toronto. So I don't know. The structure of the series would maybe make it a little different too, because, you know, if you've got a 5-game series and you steal one in Kansas City and then have to go back to Toronto, well, they could take both of those and your season's over. If it's a 7-game series and you steal one in Kansas City, maybe you've still got a chance to steal one of the three in Toronto and then take it back to Kansas City. So, you know, that's kind of another factor. But I say the Blue Jays, they are terrifying. And they got so much better while they were just kind of floating around 500 and then went on a tear. I think they won 11 in a row. They're 19-8 in the second half. They're just an offensive juggernaut. They have the best run differential in the American League. It's pretty ridiculous. So I don't want to face them at all.
Yeah. And, you know, the run differential thing is huge. And it was interesting, though, when they were 500 or below 500, they still had the best run differential in the American leagues by quite a bit.
Run games, because you could, you know, if you win 10-1, that's still one win. If you lose 4-3, that's, you know, that's what it is. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. Because if you win 10-1 and then you lose 4-3 and you lose 3-2, you know, you're 1-2, but your run differential is still 8 runs.
Right.
In the positive direction. Right. So that's the kind of thing they were doing. And now they've shored up to where those, you know, they're not losing those one run games as much anymore. And I'm not as frightened of the Blue Jays as some, I think, because first of all, they're scary right now, like this second.
Yeah.
Totally, they should be. But they're not going to continue at this pace.
Well, they had another 11-game winning streak earlier in the year too, and we're still around 500 at
right
point. So,
yeah, and you know, I mean, I suppose theoretically, you know, if you look back at like the 2007 Rockies, you know, they had
seemed
like an unsustainable streak where they won 21 out of 22 games to get to the World Series. But I don't know if that's what this Toronto Blue Jays team is. Interesting. Troy Tulowitzki was on that team as well. But it's, you know, like I mentioned before, October baseball different than July. So I think it's going to be harder for the Blue Jays hitters to get into the kind of mashing grooves that they have before, because, you know, a lot of times, say they're, you know, it's the fourth inning and there's one out. And then that's when they start lighting up the pitcher, you know, a manager. And you saw this with Yost in Toronto, you know, they're going to stick with their pitcher more to try and preserve the bullpen, try and see if the pitcher can get out of it, that kind of a thing. When it comes time in October and it's, you know, one out in the fourth inning and there's two men on, managers aren't going to mess around, you know, at least the good ones aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, Ned Yost showed that he would do this type of thing last year. He's going to pull if it's, you know, no matter who's out there, if they're struggling, he's going to pull him. He knows he's got that deep bullpen and he's going to go right to him. And, you know, the Blue Jays can still hit the relievers as they showed, but, you know, it disrupts the groove. It can disrupt the timing and, you know, whatever you want to say for why the Blue Jays are better or worse at home, you know, or not better or worse, they are better at home, but for whatever reason you want to say that they are, being able to be in the road situation where they would have the, like you said, the advantage, the home field advantage, I think is huge. Because as long as if they can steal one on the road and then take care of business at home, they're not quite as scary to me. But the team that is scary is the Houston Astros. The Royals have just not matched up well to me. The team that scares me the most. You look at the Houston Astros, they don't have the mashers that Toronto does, but they have a similar type of lineup.
They still have a lot of mashers.
Yes, a lot of power. And that's more a credit to Toronto than it is to Houston, because they've got quite the lineup. And, you know, the George Springers of the world and everything that can just crush the ball. And they've got, you know, some different types of hitters too, because you've got your Jose Altuve, who's not a big power guy, but he's still a really, really excellent hitter. And so the Astros, I think, you know, with Toronto, yeah, they've kind of shored up their bullpen. They've got Price, but, you know, their starting pitching is still like, you don't really know what you're going to get. You know, R.A. Dickey, Mark Burley, those guys, you don't really know, I don't think. And even though they've kind of strung together some good things.
Really good, or they can get hit.
Yeah. And so, and their bullpen, you know, they've had Estrada's has really, or what's the, Estrada's the starter, right? Who's the, who's their closer? Is that Osuna?
Osuna,
yeah, okay, yeah. So he's, you know, he's stepped up to the plate quite a bit, figuratively speaking, stepped up to the mound, I guess right. You could say. But you know, their bullpen is still kind of suspect, not nearly as good as the Royals is, and their defense is just okay. And you know, they're more one dimensional than the Astros.
Yeah,
the dimension is incredibly really, really good.
Yeah.
But they're still one dimensional. So if you're able to shut down their hitting, then, and you can kind of force them into some mistakes, then that's why they're not very good in those one run games. And if you're in a game where David Price isn't pitching and their bullpen can implode and they don't even get to their closer, then, you know, what do they got? Well, when you look at Houston, it's a little bit of a different story. Because, you know, they've got someone like Dallas Keuchel who can match a David Price in terms of talent as a starting pitcher. Mm-hmm. And then you've got McCullers, and their starting pitching is a little bit stronger 1-5 than the Blue Jays are. Their bullpen is very good, and their defense is it's not Royals good, but it's better than Toronto's. And like we talked about, they've still got some of the mashers on there in their lineup, and they're you know, they walk and they hit home runs and they strike out a lot, but
right.
That's kind of their only weakness. You know, I feel like when I look at Houston, they can beat you in more ways than Toronto can. Cause like I said, if Toronto's not hitting, which they haven't shown any reason to think right. that they wouldn't hit, but if they weren't, then they would be in trouble. And I almost think that might be kind of why they've had some issues, because in times when they maybe don't hit, then they kind of press a little bit in other areas and it just kind of blows up in their face. But, you know, Houston, if they're not hitting, kind of like when the Royals aren't hitting, they know they've got the pitching depth and the bullpen that they can just hang around. They'll scratch a run or two across and they'll either win the game by a run or they'll make it close or whatever. You know, Houston kind of has that feel. So to me, that's a little bit scarier than Toronto, which I wouldn't say they are, you know, de facto one-dimensional, but they're more one-dimensional than a team like Houston is.
Yeah, and the other thing is with, like, Houston, you've got Keuchel, and they picked up Cashmere, and so those are two tough lefties. And you look at the Royals, and we talked about Eric Hosmer. Well, that takes, you know, Hosmer, not necessarily out of it, but it does make it difficult against him. You get Kendrys Morales, who, you know, even though he's a switch hitter, he's less of a power guy from the right-hand side. So I think he has one home run as a right-handed hitter, and all the rest are from the left-hand side. So he still hits for a pretty good average, but, you know, if you're Morales and you're hitting singles, well, I think most teams will take that. Plus, they'll have Alex Gordon back in a playoff series, theoretically. That's another lefty, and even though he's hit lefties well, you know, those are still tough lefties. Plus, the Astros have one of the better bullpens in baseball. Really, really tough bunch of guys back there. So, yeah, it's like I said, I don't want to face any of these teams. Like, I don't, you know, we didn't talk about the Yankees really, but I don't want to face them. You know, when the Royals played them in Yankee Stadium, they just wore them out. You know, that short porch does not play to KC's strengths, but it definitely plays into what the Yankees do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, I don't want to face that either. You know, but I mean, it's just that that's kind of it. I mean, it's really those three teams are the three that I really see as the most worrisome. I mean, all the other guys, the Angels, the Royals, seem to have their number this year for whatever reason.
And last year.
Right. they haven't played the Orioles yet, which is interesting. They're going to play them.
Yeah, seven more times.
Yeah, here on this trip.
Or is it six?
It's six, seven. Seven. Yeah. It is seven, okay. It's a four in Baltimore, three in Kansas City, I think. They've owned Tampa for a while, Texas. You know, well, I mean, realistically, I don't think Tampa, Texas, or Minnesota are even going to really be in the conversation. If I had to really put anything on it, I'd say the Angels probably get that second wild card spot. So, I don't see much deviating from that. So, among those, yeah, I think Houston and Toronto are the two scariest. For me, it's Toronto, but, I mean, the Houston argument is definitely there.
Yeah, it's not to say, like, one's not scary.
Right, yeah.
It's just kind of a preference of what we see, but...
You're probably going to have to face one or the other, so...
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I saw a tweet, I think it was Rene Gisarli that tweeted it, that... Exactly 30 years ago, 1985, Royals Cardinals, obviously World Series, and Royals played the Blue Jays in the ALCS, and the Cardinals played the Dodgers in the NLCS. And right now, the odds-on favorites for making the CSs in both leagues are Royals, Blue Jays, and Cardinals, Dodgers.
Sure.
And odds-on favorites for the World Series. Cardinals Royals. So
right.
That would be incredibly epic if 30 years later the CSs are exactly the same and the World Series are the same and hopefully the exact results. Same result. Right. But like, how crazy would that be? Because you think about Royals hadn't made the playoffs 29 years after that year until last year. The Blue Jays are going on, what, 22 years now? 93 was the last time they... Yeah. And the last time they made it was when they'd won a World Series. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Cardinals, of course, and Dodgers have routinely make it. But, I mean, the confluence of events that would have to happen to recreate that scenario exactly 30 years later, just kind of interesting. Those are the... That's the symmetrical sports thing that you just love to see. In here, at least I do.
When there's so many different combinations that can happen for it to possibly happen in the same way, it's like, okay. Yes.
And interestingly enough, I was born in 1985 when the Royals won the World Series, right? Mm-hmm. And while she won't be born, I am expecting my first child, who will be born in February. So not quite the same, because I was born in season,
but
I mean, close enough to call it quite
a
coincidence. Yes. So I think it works. There's too many factors going here to ignore the coincidental nature of this together. But
so then, who's the George Orta of this Royals team?
Oof. That's a good question.
And I have to think. I didn't have anybody in mind, so I just.
I know. I'm kind of curious now. Let's see here. Let's think about this for a second. Let's see. In 1985, Orta hit four home runs, .267 batting average, .700 OPS on the dot. Let's see.
Not he really would be good a
no. There's not really a Rios. Maybe would be the best.
Orta was 34. Rios is, I guess. So we'll get a
Orta. Orta played for the White Sox and Toronto.
There you go. So
Rios played for Rios the White is, Sox and Rios Toronto.
Is gonna sneak in a single that probably should be ruled an out then and. He'll be retired anyway, but the Royals will win.
Yep.
And Cardinals fans will still complain about it.
Indeed.
It's going to be 30
years from now. Yep. That was what we'll have to look forward to. So on that note, as we've already decided, the Royals are going to win by an Alex Rios controversial single.
I think we'll end this. If we're going to mirror it, they didn't Royals didn't win it because of that.
That's right. That's right. It just happened.
But
the Royals will win it, and a controversial Rios single will happen.
That's better. Yeah.
There we go. In game six, not game, game seven.
Game six, correct.
Absolutely. Game seven was dominated. But anyway, so on that note, I think we'll leave you tonight. Lots of things. We're going to, like we said, it's kind of weird to get used to the idea of uneventful Royals baseball from the flip side, that they've just got they've been taking care of so much business. So we're going to try and dig up some kind of interesting topics. We've got an Eric Hosmer thing that we're working on that we'll bring in the future. So the next couple weeks, we'll kind of have maybe a little bit more general kind of overview, broader topics to deal with the Royals. And then as we get closer to the playoffs, then we'll start talking about the meat and potatoes of, you know, where Zobrist is going to play once Gordon gets back and all that kind of stuff. But just to give you guys the heads up on what's coming. If there's anything that you guys would like us to cover or whatever, hit us up on Kansas City. What's the Twitter handle? Is it
Kansas City BBV? At KC Baseball Vault.
Baseball Vault. Okay.
And you can also email us, KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com, or just shoot me or Jeff a message on Twitter. That's fine. I mean, we're always looking for feedback. Last week, we scheduling problems, so we couldn't really get anything recorded, but you know, we threw together a show from back in the old original days of the vault, where just got some retro stuff of Freddie Patek and Buddy Bonkalani and Greg Pryor, just telling stories of the great Royals team coming up and things like that. So if you want more of that, we have a lot of stuff from 3 or 4 years old that's not really about the current Royals teams or those Royals teams then. It's just, guys telling stories about baseball. So if you want to hear more of that, we can dig some of that up too. So shoot us some emails and let us know what you think. Let us know what you want to hear. If you want us to clarify or if you want to correct us, hey, knock yourself out. Just shoot us a message.
Absolutely.
We may read it on the air. We may not. I don't know. Depends on how it fits.
Depends on how it feel.
But, we want to hear from you. So shoot us a line.
Yeah, indeed. So with that, we will end this show. Thanks for listening. For Michael Engel and Jeff Herr, me, I'm Jeff Herr. I am your host, Jeff Herr. But for Michael Engel and myself, this has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thanks for stopping by, and as always, go Royals.